WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Thursday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me. I'll share it with the people unless you don't want me to, and then, of course, I will not do that. Coming up in the second hour of the show, it is the infamous, the notorious NWA Sports Report. All the usual suspects, we've got quite a lineup. We're going to bury 2017 NBA season. It is over. It is over. It is over. We're burying it officially. But we got NBA stuff, a bunch of it. We got boxing. Oh, Floyd. Oh, Floyd. Anyway, Jeremy Maclin coming to the Ravens. That's a blessing for the Ravens, Ravens fans. And the Penguins, Sidney Crosby, another Stanley Cup. Is Bryce Harper worth $400 million? Hell no. What? All right, that's from a diehard Orioles fan saying that. So we'll get to all of it on the NWA Sports Report coming up in the second hour of the show. But this first hour is very serious business. We have invited back to the studio the people who are behind and taking the movement forward of Baltimore ceasefire from August 4th to the 6th. We are going to engage a panel every Thursday from now, well, really from last week until August, to talk about this important event and the plight of our city. In the studio with me are Ellen G.
Hey, Sean.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good.
Let me go off of this. Ellen G is the director of the Evolution of Perspective, one of the coordinators of the Baltimore Ceasefire Movement. Ellen, welcome back. Thanks
for
joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also in the studio is David Johnson. He is sports program manager for the Parks and People Foundation, correct?
Yes.
Good to see you, brother.
Likewise, sir.
And Brother Malcolm Ruff is in the studio. He is founder of the Paja Project. And Paja, I learned, is an indigrising symbol meaning
to strike a fire.
To strike a fire. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
No, brother. Thank you for coming through. We appreciate you. So let's start off by getting you all to tell us about some of the work that you do. And David, I'll start with you before we go into everything else.
So I've been working for Parks and People Foundation for the last 4 years. We have many different programs. We've got a workforce development high school program. Our focus is mostly environmental, but we wanted to engage the middle school population because they're one of the most underserved, particularly in our city. And so we have 4 non-traditional sports offerings right now, lacrosse, baseball, soccer, and volleyball that are available to middle school age youth, grades 6 through 8.
We cannot have enough sports.
Yeah.
I mean, for real. Not sports void of academic pursuits, but we can have enough sports.
It's just a way to engage them and to keep them from maybe getting to some of what we tend to see in the evening news. It's been really beneficial for me, just to, having come from a education background, being able to step back and serve more youth in a more deep capacity.
I mean, to in a very basic way. I mean, you know, I wasn't going to get in trouble anyway because of my dad. But
nor was
that's
I.
That's just the way it was. But the reality is that, especially like during the summertime, I mean, all we did was play all different sports. Every season we played, we were masters of that sport. So it was I mean, we always had something to do. I played three sports in high school.
Okay.
And in addition to, you know, going to school and everything. So it was like I was too tired to be in the street, even if I wanted to be in the street for real. You know, but that's just a practical application for the importance of sports in lives of kids.
They don't impose that street light rule anymore.
Right,
when I was a kid, the street light was on. Yeah. I was in the house. Yeah. So
some of them not working.
True. That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. Malcolm, talk about the Paja Project. What's it all about?
All right. So the Paja Project is a nonprofit movement that myself and my future wife, Sydney Wilson, and I want to say shout out to my love.
All right.
That's what's up. That's what's up. That's
new
what's
love.
Up.
Definitely got to do that. And we wanted to allow the community to take back its power. And so we have started a movement that is exactly that, community organizing around issues that affect all of us, right? And our goal is to push our community to our highest possibilities, understanding that we have everything that we need within the community to move ourselves forward. We don't need to wait on the government. We don't need to wait on corporate America to come save us. And so we need to organize ourselves and form that power that we have within ourselves. And that's what we're all about.
100% true. I have spoken about and written about the fact that there is a political, social, economic, educational infrastructure crafted in Baltimore and has been in place for many decades for different reasons. Some of them not the fault of the people of our city, or rather our communities. That infrastructure is frayed, it's tattered, it's broken in some places, but it is there, and it's incumbent upon us to revitalize it, build it up, lift it up, and begin to utilize it again fully and completely. LNG was here last week. She is part of the Brain Trust, part of the foundation of the Baltimore Ceasefire Movement. Again, it is from August 4th to the 6th. We are asking people, we are pleading with people, we are trying to give them reasons and opportunities, no murders for 72 hours, no killing for 72 hours, nobody kill anybody for 72 hours. From August 4th to August 6th. So, Ellen, you can describe your work with the evolution of perspective and how, and for the listeners who weren't here or who didn't listen to the show last week with you and E-Wonder, Erica Bridgeford, how it all came about.
Sure. So the evolution of perspective, the way that I normally break it down for people and explain it to them is that it is an opportunity where I provide space for people to bridge the communication gap. And that sounds like something very, like, oh, my goodness, what is that? But it literally is that. So I use social media. I use space to bring people together, to help people find, first, to give them an opportunity to share their perspective on whatever it is that we're talking about. And secondly, for us to give them an opportunity for their perspective to grow if it needs to, or to be strengthened if that needs to happen. Erica and I are soulmates, and when she had the idea, she was having a conversation with her son about the record number of murders in Baltimore City, and Erica is one of those people where if something is bothering her a lot, inside herself, she says, okay, that means that I need to do something. So she rallied her troops and decided to call a ceasefire 12:01 a.m. Friday, August the 4th through 11:59 p.m. Sunday, August the 6th. And essentially what we're trying to do is to create space in the city, to create camaraderie in the city, and to give people an opportunity to celebrate life, because we've been mourning in the city for a very long time.
Indeed. So I'm saying, let's have some cookouts, let's play some house music, you know, let's have a good time.
Yeah.
And just make sure, you know, we keep each other safe for at least 72 hours. So I wrote about the Baltimore ceasefire in my column this week in the Afro, the race and politics column. And you know, it was almost like right after we talked about it, the city just kind of blew up again.
Again.
The Monday into, so we did the show last Thursday. the Monday into Tuesday night, Monday night into Tuesday night, this past Monday into Tuesday night, six people were killed
right
overnight. There was the weekend before we did the show.
What, 12 people were shot and one person was killed.
Yeah. Or 14, actually. 14,
right.
Yeah, 14 were shot. Mm-hmm. So the reality of our city right now, and I believe 160 homicides before Father's Day, we're on pace to shatter the horrific record of 2015. As far as homicides are concerned, I believe shootings are up as well. We are also per capita now. If anybody wants to correct me, I'm hoping someone can. But I believe per capita, we are the most murderous city in the United States. Chicago has more murders, but they have 3 million, more than 3 million people.
Right.
So, so we are up against some serious odds. I wrote in my column this week that, and I think I mentioned this during the show, that the last few weeks have reminded me back during the 1980s when I would come home from college and to lifeguard during the summers, and crack had just began to implode Baltimore City and cities all across the United States. It reminded me of those bad old days of hearing Uzi submachine gun fire all night long. Living two blocks away from like North and Longwood and those neighborhoods and off of Gwynns Falls Parkway. Those aren't good memories, you know, and it's like those days kind of have not gone away. So against that backdrop, we come forward with this prayer that for 72 hours we can keep each other safe. As I say that, I saw a story in the Washington Post about Baltimore talking about McCullough Holmes and focusing on the children who grew up or were growing up in that part of the city in West Baltimore where The Wire was filmed back when it was on the air. And they have a feature also in here about this young man named Khalil Bridges. I don't want to misspeak, but I think he may be a student at Renaissance Academy, but I'm not sure because I don't see the actual I don't see them identifying the school in the caption. But the thing that really got my attention is it says coming of age in a city coming apart. I don't know if we're coming apart, but some days it feels kind of like we are. LNG.
Right. The energy in the city is tense. And I think coming apart is strong. And Baltimore, to me, and I'm sure that there are other people who will disagree, but Baltimore doesn't feel like a war zone. It doesn't feel like a place where, like, I am acutely aware of the places in Baltimore where I go where something might happen.
Right.
But the entire city doesn't
I agree with that. I don't think the entire city. No, definitely not the entire city.
Well, if we look at the last homicide to have been recorded, that was a homicide that happened on the Cannon waterfront. A gentleman who worked at Riley's Oyster House.
Right.
That's right.
You know, there's a lot of different stages of coming apart, right? And maybe we are in that early frayed stage because, you know, not only do we have this ridiculous amount of homicides and shootings going on, but on the other side, you see zero opportunity for our children to succeed, period.
Right.
I think back to the most disgusting thing I've seen recently was the six schools in Baltimore City that could not have one student proficient in any subject whatsoever.
Right.
For that to be the state of affairs, it does not take, you know, rocket science to see why we're in the situation that we're in.
And to that point, I think, and I want to make this point, and I've thought about writing about it. When you mentioned those six schools, brother, one of those schools was Douglas High School.
Correct.
And when you think about the history of Douglas High School, this is the school that birthed Thurgood Marshall.
Right. It was the colored high school.
Right.
My great-grandmother graduated from the colored high school. My grandmother graduated from the colored high school.
Right.
And I've seen that diploma on my grandmother's wall, right? And for that to be now the tradition of the Ducks, you know, the mighty Ducks of Frederick Douglass, which would have been my zone school from where I grew up, right? And imagine where I would have been. There may not have been a Duke University. There may not have been a you know, University of Baltimore Law School. There wouldn't be a brother out here fighting for people in the criminal justice system, another brother out here doing that. And we really have to look at what opportunities are we granting to our children, and what sacrifices are we willing to make as a people, as a government, as a community, to ensure that our children, our next generation, really is able to carry on the torch and do better.
Indeed. I also think that it's important to because I agree with everything that you just said. I also think that it's important to consider what is happening that sacrifices can't be made. So there is when I hear people talk about how we're so consumed with entertainment and reality TV and the music and all of those things, like I get how that is connected to how we're failing our children. But everybody out here is not watching reality TV. Everybody is not participating in those things. So for me, the question is, where is the disconnect for the people? So you have some people over here who are doing these things and people over here who are not doing these things. And it doesn't seem to matter whether you're doing them or not. Like, our children are kind of all in the same situation. And how does that happen?
I think it kind of speaks to the narrative that is being formed. When we were talking about this in the green room, oftentimes, you know, people don't hear about an Ellen G or a Malcolm Ruff. Big props to Sean for, you know, bringing light to these type of individuals in this type of work, because some of it is, yes, we get preoccupied with, you know, the everyday rigmarole, or, you know, we get, you know, too overly involved in, you know, keeping up with statistics in sports or watching reality TV when, you know, our kids are being neglected. So it's a myriad of different issues that contribute to why we are where we are. But I think light needs to be shed more on the individuals and the work that's being done by organizations and people who are trying to be more impactful and make a difference. With this rate that we're looking at, we're a city of 600,000 people. Of that 600,000, there aren't 1,000 who are committing these acts. So we need to figure out who those people are, and hold them accountable. One, we can't just look to law enforcement, or we can't look to the schools.
Right.
We got to start inwardly. We have to look within ourselves and in the mirror first. That's where it starts. Any significant transformation that's going to take place or take shape in the city, it has to start with us as individuals. Even those who are doing the work, how much more can we do? How deeper can we be?
And to that
impactful?
Point, to that point, law enforcement knows who those people are, quite frankly.
Right.
To a great extent, those people are kind of in a revolving door of the justice, the criminal justice system. And that's a whole nother conversation.
Right.
But to your point, brother, I mean, we have to assume, we can't absolve ourselves of guilt. We have to assume responsibility for each other. Back to your point, well, both of your points, actually. You know, we all engage in the work that we engage in. My friend calls it light work, light workers. And that's I think that's an apt description. But you know what happens, and there are hundreds of us around the city who are doing this great work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But what happens is, it seems as though, almost as if the atmosphere is permeated with some of the other stuff that you were talking about, Ellen. I mean, the music, the other. And it's almost like we just put our heads down and just deal with it. But at the same time, I think, I don't know, it feels like a overwhelming kind of sensation sometimes to hear and see everything. And I think the really big piece that I keep talking about and on this show, and even privately, is the mental health issue in Baltimore City.
Oh my goodness,
is one
yes.
that we are dropping the ball. I was walking down to the Safeway from the Afro on 25th and Charles, and it seemed like if there were 20 people on the streets, 10 of them were not doing well.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's a pretty consistent reality in our city.
And the idea that we rely on intangible things like religion, and this is no diss to religion, but, you know, it takes a certain I feel like it takes a certain kind of spirit to be able to be lifted out of a depression if you're relying on religion.
You can't pray everything away.
Right.
And that's, again, not a shot.
There's a certain kind of person who can accomplish that. And the average, I don't believe that the average person is not because they don't want to, but just able to accomplish praying away what is wrong with them.
Like
so
I said, faith without works.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not only that, but when you're dealing with mental health.
Right.
You know, in our community, mm-hmm. particularly with men, it's frowned upon. You're weak.
It's a stigma.
You know, yeah, there's a stigma that goes along with that, and we have to find a way to shake that in order for us to help these individuals, because some of what we're seeing could be a result of untreated mental health issues.
I think a lot of it is. Yeah. And so men can't express themselves, and women are unable to because
they looked at the angry black woman, or, you know.
And that anger is not. It's not anger. It's depression. It's anxiety. It's being unsupported in a lot of different ways. And I think that in our community, we look to the surface and we look at behaviors as what is wrong with the person.
Right.
My good friend Michelle Stafford posted. I had asked the question, "What is wrong with you?" And she said, "That's not the question to ask. The question to ask is, what happened to you?"
Yes.
To make you respond to life this way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're not asking that question.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a quick break. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. Gene, we'll get to your phone call after we come back from the break. I'm in the studio with David Johnson, Malcolm Ruff, and Ellen G. We're talking about the Baltimore ceasefire, August 4th through the 6th, 72 hours without murder in our city. Put your weapons down at least for 72 hours. We'll continue our conversation and we'll get your phone call, Gene, after the break. You're listening to First Edition. Welcome back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. We continue our conversation connected to the Baltimore ceasefire August 4th through the 6th. Every Thursday here on First Edition. From now until then, we are going to engage a panel in a discussion about violence and homicide in Baltimore with an eye towards solutions for our city. In the studio with me are David Johnson, sports program manager for the Parks and People Foundation. Brother Malcolm Ruff is here also. He's founder of the Paja Project. And Ellen G. is director of the Evolution of Perspective, and she's one of the coordinators of the Baltimore ceasefire movement. Let me take this phone call real quick. Let's go to Gene first in Pikesville. Gene, you're on First Edition. How you doing, brother?
Yeah, pretty good. How's everyone doing?
All right.
Hello.
So
how's
hey, Gene.
I'm old, and I just woke up from my nap. It's always a pleasure to wake up. It's always a pleasure to wake up hearing Sean's voice.
Oh, bless you, man.
Yeah,
bless you.
The first time I heard Sean was in an interview that he did with Brother Israel Kason.
Oh, okay.
And I've been a fan since then.
Oh, bless you, Gene. I appreciate you.
Yeah, man. So anyway, apprenticeships.
Mm-hmm.
If our purpose is to educate our children and then navigate them through the process so that at the end they are either employable or they can become entrepreneurs, why doesn't the education systems, why isn't the education system's purpose is to provide a pathway to that result? Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense.
A lot of sense, Gene.
Okay, so I that's what frustrates me. Everything I've ever done has been some form of an apprenticeship.
Right.
I'm matriculated through and survived Southeast Asia, came home, survived drugs, found myself sitting in Morgan's Library, ducking a incident that I screwed up in, dealing with navigating through, the system that these young sleeping in those comfortable chairs, patient for affirmative action.
Right.
But I was years, but I learned how to navigate.
Well, there were circumstances that gave high school at Walbrook. We had an internship at the News American, a daily newspaper. We were the only high school kids in the city that had that type of internship at the daily newspaper. They treated us like young. We were young journalists, and I say to this day that I could have went straight from high school. I could have been like LeBron. I could have went straight from high school to writing for a professional newspaper. I really believe that with all my heart. And you may want to call it a mentorship, apprenticeship, whatever you want to call it. I had people who were in my corner who were bringing me along. And those situations, I'm not going to say they don't exist because I know this brother right here is about to tell me that they do, but they don't exist enough. There aren't enough of those.
Actually, what I was going to say was that's a part of what's perpetuating what we see.
All right, then I was wrong. Because I'm right.
You're right. Exactly. There aren't trades in schools. There aren't mentorships because corporate America would prefer our kids come out of school and build their institutions instead of trying to build something of their own.
Exactly.
So that's done with
come
intent.
On,
I mean, that's it's not a mistake that this is happening.
That is not
so
a mistake.
Those of us who are in positions or have the capacity to do that, I guess we just have to find a way to do more with limited resources. But just mentorship is not necessarily I'm going to give you a job when you finish with this. Mentorship could be I'm going to take you along and show you what I do.
It needs to be more like village ship, right? That's
Amen.
Really what we got to get going on because, you know, we got kids out here dying. We got men out here dying. 72% of the people who have been killed this year, right? Just based on, I went through miscellaneous posts, right?
Everybody knows
miscellaneous posts, right? Because we're all sitting there watching the ticker, see how many people, how many lives, right? How many actual real people are being killed every day, 160. And I went through it right before the Paja Project last event, and 72% of the people killed in Baltimore City were between the age of 20 and 39, right? It's a genocide, right? And if you think about Charmaine Wilson, right?
Incredible story.
Who now 8 children, right? 2 grandchildren, 6 children have lost their mother, their life source, right? Their provider, their protector.
Because one of her sons, I believe, was being bullied.
Yeah. Being bullied.
Mm-hmm. And she tried to do something about it, and they killed her as a result. They reminded me of the Dawson family.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have made that correlation. And think about it. What's the response been? What's the response from the village ship been, right? What's the response? Like, if that was your mother, right? This is what Munir is talking about.
Yeah.
Right? If that was your mother, right? Wouldn't you be down in Emerson Avenue? Where, is that where
you'd
it was?
You'd be all
down
up
bottom?
In that. It was, yeah.
Right. There would be, if that was my mother, right, I would have all of my people. We would be ready to go.
Right.
Right. And so that is the problem. We're in a state of helplessness. We're in a state of fear.
It's fear. Like, when you constantly are seeing stories like this, people are, they are paralyzed.
That's what I was
on their
say.
Couches with fear. Like, people are afraid to come outside during the day, because some of these instances are happening in broad daylight. And so a part of the narrative that we have to be more responsible for changing is we've got to promote the positive things that are going on around the city, because it's not just homicide. And true, it's out of control, but there are programs, there are people who are doing great work, and we need to promote and lift them a bit more.
Well, to that point, brother, I mean, the fear factor is something that we talk about often on this show, in the second hour during different segments. But what Ellen was talking about, depression, anxiety, that many times is connected to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Absolutely.
And that's really what, at the root. Fear is the father of all evil.
Yeah. Right.
Everything
no
negative you can think of, every negative emotion that you can think of, every negative thing you can think of is rooted in fear. And that is what's our city seems to be in the grip of, that fear right now.
And people get paralyzed into protective mode. So if I witness other people standing up for their family and being murdered for that, am I willing? Like, is that the stand that I want to take when it's time for me? Like, because it's almost like, okay, you are essentially picking the lesser of two evils. Do I not say anything and live to be able to protect my children? Or do I say something and risk being murdered and not being here for them at all? There is no win in
That's
that situation. There is no win.
Right. Right, but it's an easy choice. Like just on Fox, when they invested, when they did their story on Charmaine Wilson, people did not want to be identified who knew her from her block, because they're saying, I don't want to be identified. I don't want to be targeted by the forces that be, right? But the good thing about fear, Sean, is that I saw this piece the other day that fear, there's only two fears that you come into the world with, right, as a child, right? The two fears are loud noises and falling. Okay. Like those are the only two innate fears that you can possibly have, and every other fear you have is learned, right? Right. And if it's learned, that means it can be corrected, right? And that's where we have to focus all our efforts, right? We need to all make sacrifices to change the culture of our communities, change hearts and minds of the people in our communities, reach the people that are feeling that there's no opportunity, reach the people that feeling that there's no other option but for them to kill their homeboys, kill their people that are actually their family, right? I represent people in the courts all over Maryland as a defense attorney, criminal defense attorney. And recently I saw a video where it was a gentleman, there were two young men walking down the street. It's a homicide video. And they both walk up to the same house. They're obviously together. They obviously trust each other in some way. And one guy goes to knock on the door. The other dude looks down the street and just blows him away as the guy's not even looking. This is a lawless, codeless type of situation we have going on. And I don't mean to hog up airtime, but the last thing I would say is we also have some unintended consequences that are happening based on good work that's being done by the police, right? Mm-hmm. There's a huge drug raid, huge drug bust that just happened, right? And what happens when you wipe out a certain power in any infrastructure, there's a power vacuum, right? Yep. And when you have a power vacuum, you have a struggle, right? And that's a part of what we're also seeing. Mm-hmm. It is a power vacuum that is causing a lot of violence to happen.
You know, I want to interject and touch upon what you just talked about, Brother Malcolm. I would offer and say specifically to the Baltimore City Police Department, a department that is embattled right now with several cases of misconduct. We talk about them all the time here on First Edition, but we also give the caveat of the men and women who are doing tremendous work. I would invite, I think, and this is not to disparage the public relations of the Baltimore City Police Department. I would think it would be helpful to hear more about the positive work, I mean, in a broader way that the Baltimore City Police Department does, because right now they're getting slammed, you know, they're getting slammed because of what and I'll put it like this: I stand by every story, everything I've ever written, everything I've ever said about the police department, because it's all true.
Right.
However, we need to hear about the positive works that these brothers and sisters, these men and women of the department are doing, because right now there's such an imbalance about what's been said that there is zero trust right now.
I think that some healing has to happen before the people would be willing to even want to hear about the positivity that's been happening with the police. Like the fact that there appears to be no accountability when police clearly violate community trust.
Oh, there's no doubt.
So I would prefer, speaking for myself, I would prefer for there to be accountability before I celebrate anything good that you're doing.
Yeah, I feel you. I mean, but we're still on the same page. I just think that part of that healing has to be people have to know.
That's
because,
true.
Because if all you hear is, they robbing us.
Right.
They beating us up. They're killing us. But which they are doing.
Right.
Be clear. They're doing it. They're getting down. I mean, the cat Marcus Taylor, one of the Baltimore seven cats indicted for racketeering. He said, "Let me out of jail because everybody's doing it."
Right.
Mm. Wow.
Everybody's
That's
doing
exactly
it.
What it's he not said. A good look when you're right down the street from the strip circuit. Like I was riding past yesterday on my way to a meeting and I was just annoyed. I said to myself, this is the headquarters for our police department right here, and not a block away you got all kind of stuff going on,
all kinds
out of
activity.
Those joints. And then City Hall's around the corner. So
that's an interesting point.
It kind of speaks to where we are as a city to me. Yeah. I kind of was like, well, you know, we want to make all these changes and, you know, we want for things to get better. But then if you look, I mean, just the visual.
Right.
Like, imagine that. I haven't been to every black city in America, but I imagine not many have a strip.
That's an interesting point,
joint,
brother.
Right? Across the street, literally from where the headquarters for the police
right.
department is. So a part of the imagery has got to change. Maybe, I don't know.
So I'm born and raised in West Baltimore. So and when I was a younger man, I'm not going to say I've stayed. I'm not gonna say that I've never been. I've done a couple of places. I'm from here, so I've been a couple of places.
Can I counsel you?
You know, yeah. I need help. You know, I need my legal help here. But the reality is that you grow up and you think you're used to it. That's what you're used to.
Yeah.
The police department right across the street from the block.
Yep.
City Hall right around the corner from. And you don't, and be, and I've lived different, I've lived in Detroit, I've lived in Los Angeles, I've been all over the country, but wow, you're right. It's like, why is this?
I don't know. It dawned on me.
It was a clear choice, too, because at the end of the day, Gay Street is named Gay Street because of the gaiety that was happening
right,
there.
That's right.
That's a tradition. That
right.
block being traditionally
a reveler's block.
A reveler's block, right?
That's
the,
a great point.
The burlesque block, right?
Yeah.
Right. And they put the police station there. But at the end of the day, I really don't even think it was that deep. But it is a bad look, right? And I do agree with you, Ellen, that like there has to be a lot of healing because there is an us and them dynamic.
Absolutely.
That is clear, and it is not in a good state right now. But without a doubt, we need the police, right? We need them to be good. We need them to be thoughtful. And so I think we... With people being held accountable now, right? These seven guys, depending on what happens with them, right? That will go a long way to serve the relationship for bringing the police back into this village ship, right? Into our village. Because there was a point, probably 40 years ago,
mm-hmm.
But there was a point where the police were a part of the village.
Absolutely true.
But there was a reason that it changed.
Right.
And the reason that it changed is not common knowledge and it's not something that people know, like the policies that were instituted that changed police engagement with the community and how they engage with the community. Like that was intentional.
Yeah, and promulgated from the top.
Right.
Of course.
I remember being in Catonsville and listening to a Baltimore City police officer say to me, "We're not trained," and these were his words, "we're not trained to de-escalate a situation. If I walk into a situation and whatever the level of escalation is, I am trained to escalate one level above that." Mm-hmm. So if you have a knife, I can pull out my gun. If you have a gun, I can shoot you. These were his words.
And I think to Brother Malcolm's point, I mean, when we went into, or could have even been before, when we went into the philosophy of mass incarceration under Bill Clinton, the trickle-down effect of that was
mm-hmm.
law enforcement decided to take on the persona that you just...
But
yeah.
even back to Nixon.
Oh, sure.
With the
first
war on drugs.
Drugs.
Right.
First
right.
War. That's what
the fake war on drugs.
First, yeah.
That's,
right. That's what
on.
I'm referring to
yeah.
is,
yeah.
is
no
that
one's
we
wanting.
Knew that that was a lie, but we did it anyway
yeah.
because
yeah. Yeah.
of race. Right.
right.
I think, too, with policing, you have to look at, their role. They are reactionary. And
mm-hmm.
so it goes back to Brother Malcolm's point about the village. We have to be the de-escalators.
Yes.
And I think because of that fear and that paralysis, because of the fear, a lot of times we'll hear, like, you see this in black communities all the time, probably other communities as well, but I live in a black community, so I'm going to speak from experience. You hear somebody arguing outside, you peer out the window, but are you going to go out there and, like, say, "Hey, guys, you know.
You know, what's up?
Hey,
come on, chill out."
Nine times out of 10, you're probably not.
I have, and I will. I watched
Peace and Power to
I
you
watched,
for going out there.
So I'm coming home one day and I see a car crashed into a light pole on the corner. And I'm looking to see what is going on to see if anybody needs help. Two women were fist fighting inside of the car.
After
they
crashed.
Inside of the car. That's how
the
car
crashed. Yeah.
So I get out of my car. I walk over to them. I'm cautious about it because I understand it's a tense situation. And I ask them, "Do you need some help?" And they pause long enough to, and they're like, no, we don't need any help. And I'm like, are you sure you don't need any help? Because it looks like you need some help. The women stopped long enough to they didn't tell me to mind my business, but their body posture was like, can you mind your business? And so I walked back to my car further away from them, and I stood there, and they started fighting again.
Mm-hmm.
I called the police. The police never came.
Mm-hmm.
Never came.
May I ask what community you have?
Irvington.
Okay.
Yeah. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yos, your host. We are engaged in a conversation, in an ongoing series of conversations about the Baltimore ceasefire, August 4th to the 6th. We're talking about violence and homicide in our city, but we're talking about solutions as well within our communities. I'm in the studio with David Johnson, who is sports program manager for the Parks and People Foundation. Malcolm Ruff is founder of the Paja Project, and Ellen G is director of the Evolution of Perspective. She is one of the coordinators of the Baltimore ceasefire, August 4th to 6th, 72 hours, no murder, no homicide. We have to take care of each other, at least for those 72 hours, keep everybody safe. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Brother Will in Baltimore. Will, you're on First Edition. How you doing? Will, you there? There we go. Go ahead, brother.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, brother.
Yes, I want to say hello to you and all your panel.
Thank you, brother.
Boy, you guys have hit the nail on the head on every topic that you spoke about. I think the one thing that's missing is that residents of the city have to stand up and take their city back. I can understand the fear part. Mm-hmm. I can completely understand the fear part. But you can go in your house. You know the drug dealers on the corner. You see them hustling, so forth and so on. And, you know, call them repeatedly about it. You know, we've lost sense of community. You know, when neighborhoods, you know, that have their particular names used to have a community association as well.
Absolutely.
Non-existent. Non-existent.
That's
they're here. They're here. But
No. I'll say non-existent in the communities that they need to be in.
Okay.
No, there are neighborhood associations. I think it's not so much that they don't exist. I think the level of participation is not at the capacity that is needed to be to affect positive change in the community.
And here's the thing that I would say, and Will, thank you for your comment. These community associations have not been lifted up.
Right.
It is to me an abysmal crime that the leadership of Baltimore City has not, in a very methodical way, gone into many of these neighborhoods and embraced these neighborhood associations.
Yep.
Because these people who are active within these associations have been doing incredible work in their communities for decades. They know what's going on. Mm-hmm. They understand the terrain. They understand what's happening within those communities. They are a vital resource to the city. And we ignore them and don't engage them at our own peril. That is our reality. I mean, we can find $17 million to add to the law enforcement budget, $17 million to add to make it $497 million.
And you're firing teachers.
You're firing teachers, and you can't find money for neighborhood associations that have been doing incredible work in our city, for decades. That's an L.
And you have proof of police officers, you know, stealing massive amounts of overtime. The most recent was, I believe he was a lieutenant that was overseeing the casino district.
Living in Wicomico County, literally driving back and forth every day in a police car.
Right.
Worcester County, down by Ocean City.
Wow.
So he's living near Ocean City. He's driving to Baltimore every day. He's stealing overtime money. He's maybe skimming from the casino. I mean, this sounds like Goodfellas almost.
And then you have Douglas.
Right. Exactly.
That's the juxtaposition, right? That's Baltimore.
That's Baltimore.
Or you have one of these neighborhoods where, you know, you see the politicians when it's re-election time.
Right.
But you don't see them at a community meeting. But shout out to the brothers that's doing it. Shout out to
the ones who are
Sean Sinek, Christopher Burnett.
Absolutely.
Brandon Scott, brothers who are in these communities. I don't even live in his district. I called Brandon for a few things, and 15 minutes later, it was done. So, yeah, Nick Mosby, all the brothers and sisters who are out here doing, Shannon Sneed, that are out here doing the great work in these communities.
John
props
Bula.
To you all, you know.
Everybody, yeah.
But as the brother was saying, you know, as far as these community associations, we do as a community have to become more engaged. And I think part of it is just unplugging. Like, the fear comes from constantly bombarding yourself subconsciously and consciously with all the negativity. I mean, it's rough and it definitely needs to be addressed, but you can't take on the beast if you're constantly, you know, under its influence. Mm. So,
and waiting, right?
Yeah, you got to unplug or exactly, waiting for this miracle worker, this savior, this Brother Malcolm, or this, not Brother Malcolm Ruff, because he's doing it.
But Brother Malcolm Ruff.
But that's what I'm out here doing. That's right. Why I started the Paja Project, because at the end of the day, we need people to encourage every single one of our citizens, every single one of our community, our family, to step up and make sacrifices and make it a priority that community needs to be right after family, right? Because the family unit
Well, community
is,
needs to be family.
Right,
that's
right.
What
it needs
be.
To be like one and one A.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, you know, and people think it's odd that me as a defense attorney am out here trying to promote these you know, these tenets, but we have to have a code, right? At the end of the day, you know, my profession is my profession,
right?
But we still have to have a code as a community,
but
right?
It shouldn't be odd, because you see it up close and personal, brother. You right. know what's happening,
right? That, and that's why it's so.
So
I was a really? Prosecutor.
Okay, I didn't know that.
But I wasn't a career prosecutor.
Okay.
Let's take another phone call. Let's go to Kevin in West Baltimore. Kevin, you're on First Edition. How you doing, brother?
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I would like to save some answers, and I'll give you some solutions.
Okay,
the first thing needs to happen, Kevin Davis, the police commissioner, needs to be fired immediately.
Okay.
And I just want to push back on the gentleman on your panel, which I'm a resident homeowner in Sandtown, Winchester.
Uh-huh.
And for him to say Nick Mosley had done anything for us, he must not live in Sandtown, Winchester. Thirdly, when you talk about the young sister that was murdered with the 8 kids who happened to live in public housing, Rosemount, Duclin, why don't someone ask the mayor why there is not a commissioner of housing or executive director?
Well,
Kevin,
I think you know the reason for that. Graziano's out.
Right.
And he hasn't been replaced, to my knowledge. Yeah, Kevin. Let's take one more call.
Thank you for perspective, though, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean.
Yep.
Yeah, it's appreciated.
Let's go to Theodore in Baltimore County. Theodore, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
I appreciate all the good work that you and everybody that I don't know and the ones that are about to coming up are doing.
Thank you, brother.
We got a lot of people in our community, and everybody there knows it's spiritual. Everybody knows it's spiritual, because love thy neighbor as thyself. If you don't, you're going to answer for it down the road, or maybe sooner or later. Mm. But, you know, the sad fact of it is, we in this country, I love everybody, but we're occupied. And none of you are old enough, but if you ever ride by a building in Baltimore City, it's being torn down. You might see something spray painted, Black October.
I'm old enough, brother.
No,
I'm the
disrespect. I love life. Black October took care of drug dealers. I'm not going to say what they did.
I know what they did,
but
brother.
If they were able, if anybody could pass a law, we will allow you to clean up your own community.
Wow.
And they warned people 3 times.
Wow.
And after the 3rd time, people disappeared. And the thing about it, when you aren't able... Because what the police did, like the Panthers, they infiltrated Black October. You can't have them people cleaning up their own communities and not taking the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you got that. Now, there should be a program also to do this. You tell somebody, 2 or 3 young men, I'll pay for your college, I'll pay for your graduate school, but you have to sign an agreement to be a Baltimore City police officer for 10 years, 15 years, whatever. If you did that, you'd get people in the community, but because it's spiritual, you're not going to stop. I'd like to ask you my hypothetical question.
You
40,000 jobs.
You're going, baby.
A lot of good time.
Oh, yes. I heard you, though.
Man.
We are unfortunately out of time, but wow, we touched on a lot of things. We did some traveling. I want to thank you all. We will be back next Thursday to continue our conversation about the Baltimore ceasefire, offering solutions to homicide and violence in our city. Baltimore ceasefire is August 4th through the 6th, 72 hours, no murder,
yes,
no homicide.
Pick
no
up
violence.
The gloves if you got to.
Yes.
I mean, come on. Like, put the guns down, man.
Guns. Stop being a coward.
Go to the body. Gloves.
I want to thank my guests for coming through. David Johnson, sports program manager for the Parks and People Foundation. Thank you,
thank
David.
You. Thank you.
Appreciate
for having
you.
Me, brother.
Brother Malcolm Ruff of the Paja Project. Thank you, brother.
Yes, indeed.
Appreciate
P-A-G-Y-A. Find us on Facebook. Come to our next event, which hopefully will be on August the 5th during the Baltimore ceasefire.
Amen to that.
Love you, Yos. Appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. Ellen G is the director of the Evolution of Perspective and one of the coordinators of the Baltimore ceasefire movement. Sis, love you.
Thank you. Love you back. We'll be back next Thursday.
We'll be back next Thursday. All right. We're going to take a break when we come back. It is the NWA Sports Report. Stay tuned.